Hello, everyone. Welcome to A Little of This, A Little of That, a program dedicated to conversation, information, people, and places. Your host is Dan Delman. I'm a retired academic looking for an audience. I hope you'll be a part of it. Each of our programs is a potpourri of items from several or all of these categories to inform you and to amuse you. In today's program, the first feature of our potpourri is an article from Bloomberg News. It's entitled, "The World is Still Flat," by Michael Schumann. Schumann says, Brexit won't stop globalization. Beyond the West, links are growing and deepening. His article begins with the following. Globalization, that irresistible force that was inevitably, inexorably making the world flat, looks to be in retreat. Trade growth has never recovered to the levels reached before the 2008 financial crisis. A presidential candidate is fueling a campaign of fear, of free trade and immigration. The economic problems of the U.S. are the consequence of a leadership class that worships globalization over Americanism, so this person says. Then came Brexit, the worst setback for the European Union, that most ambitious experiment in globalization. Money manager Bill Gross said, Brexit marks the end of globalization as we've known it. But is he correct? In a sense, he is. But there's more to it than that. The rich West launched globalization on the ideal that nations tied together by bonds of trade, money, and culture are less likely to destroy one another. Now those in the U.S. and Europe who believe themselves hurt by the massive changes wrought by globalization, want to reverse it. Isolationism is being heralded as independence. But anyone who thinks globalization is dead misreads what's really happening. While there are pockets of resistance, much of the world is still forging tighter links between countries, between companies, and between communities. Rather than retrenching, globalization is deepening and expanding. Whether you are an angry supporter of that presidential candidate or a British Leave voter, Leave or not, this new and perhaps even more exciting phase of globalization present serious challenges for policymakers, especially in the U.S. and in Europe. As working classes suffering from stagnant incomes and joblessness lash out at the free movement of money, goods, and people, their elected politicians face pressure to detach from an increasingly interconnected world. In doing so, though, they may cede to non-Western competitors the potential benefits these fresh linkages will create. The fate of nations may depend on whether they continue to embrace globalization. That's been the case for decades. The first round of globalization was, generally, a movement from the West to the rest. As the open exchange encouraged by the U.S.-led global economic system and advancing technology smoothed the way for doing business on an international scale, finance and factories flowed from the richest countries to the poorest countries. And with them came global doctrines, Western doctrines, from capitalism to evangelical Christianity. And from Western culture came McDonald's and Mickey Mouse. The countries that took advantage: China, Japan, South Korea, and yes, the United States, reaped the rewards. Developing countries alleviated poverty on an unprecedented scale, while advanced nations gained greater economic efficiency. Countries that sat on the sidelines: Russia, much of the Middle East, and Africa, are still trying to make up lost ground. The success of that early phase of globalization has spawned another, and one that moves in all directions. Emerging economies are knitting closer ties among themselves as China and India and others gain in wealth, in clout, and in confidence. The World Trade Organization figures that 52% of developing countries' exports went to other emerging economies in 2014, and this was up 38% from the mid-1990s. Trade between China and India was about $2 billion in late 1990s, but by 2014, it had ballooned to $72 billion. India's total trade with Africa grew more than 60% in only 4 years to almost $48 billion in the country's 2014-2015 fiscal year. Most of the world continues to pursue free trade, even as some say that NAFTA is a disaster and that Brexit excises Europe's second largest economy from the continent's integrated market. China's pushing for a pan-Asian free trade zone. The 10-member Association of Southeast Asian Nations is forming a common market, and African countries have started negotiating a continent-wide free trade area. Today's globalization is also drawing in countries previously left out. Textile and apparel manufacturers from Bangladesh, from China, and from Turkey invested over $2 billion in Ethiopia last year to open factories there to export to the U.S. and to Europe. The Philippines, long a laggard in the region, which is replete with hyper-connected economies, has become a major hub for call centers. Companies from the emerging world are becoming more important investors as well. According to the American Enterprise Institute, Chinese companies invested $111 billion around the world last year. That's more than 10 times the amount in 2005. The total that Indian companies have invested abroad, at $139 billion last year, rose 43% in only 5 years. This is growing faster than the amount of foreign money invested in India. During a June visit to China, Russian President Vladimir Putin said the two countries are jointly undertaking investment projects worth $50 billion. Growing antipathy toward immigrants has not kept people at home, however. The World Bank estimates that the number of international migrants rose to a record 251 million last year. More than 38% of them moved from a developing country to another developing country in 2013, compared with 34% to advanced economies. Those who blame globalization for their problems think they'll be better off watching from the sidelines, but early indications say otherwise. The pound's steep post-Brexit swoon is a signal that investors believe the UK is less competitive outside an integrated Europe than within it. In Paris and in Frankfurt, bankers and politicians are eager to capitalize on Brexit to siphon off financial business from London. Instead of pandering to isolationist forces, politicians would do better to address their very real concerns directly. Workers displaced by free trade need more intensive training to prepare them for new jobs. University education must become less expensive and vocational schools more available. Allowing labor a greater voice in corporate management will help wage earners share more equitably in the profits globalization creates for big business. As the world continues to flatten, opponents of that inevitable, inexorable change must mind the edge. Another feature of our global economy is oil. Oil has entered a new era. For the first time in decades, no entity is trying to regulate oil supplies. Not the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, not Saudi Arabia. The implications to this are huge. This shift has been talked about for years, but now systemic changes are taking hold. The leader, OPEC, was dead. Saudi Arabia has decided it's better off pumping as much oil as it can. This is not a temporary tactic. It's a new world view of energy. Once the hydraulic fracturing or fracking boom in the United States took hold, attempts to reduce supply to keep prices up look futile. Plus, the Saudis are competing with Iran for leadership of the Middle East. Iran wants foreign companies to invest in its oil industry and rebuild its production. By keeping prices low, the Saudis are making that investment as unattractive as possible. Finally, they foresee the world turning away from oil-based transportation to alternatives such as electric-powered cars. From the Saudi perspective, it's better to sell as much as possible now than to wait until prices could well be lower. The OPEC era is over. It's done. It's gone, says Jim Burkhard, who's head of oil market analysis at Market Research IHS in Washington. The concern has changed from will there be enough supply in 50 years to will there be enough demand in 50 years? Production is growing, but world demand, fueled by low gasoline prices, is growing even more. As a result, the oil glut is shrinking. By the end of this year, and perhaps as early as the next quarter, production worldwide could fall below world demand. That would be the first time that it's happened since 2013. And now some information that should be useful to residents of northern Illinois, especially northeastern Illinois, the area that is served by Northern Illinois University. Now it's September, and so that means in September that LLI, or the Lifelong Learning Institute at Northern Illinois University, is about to offer its fall schedule of courses. LLI is an institution within Northern Illinois University which offers non-credit courses to retirees and those who are 55 and over. This is a particularly good deal because you can pay once and then take all of the courses that you want to. You can drop in on one course on one day and another course another day, or you can go to courses morning and afternoon for 3 days straight. So beginning on September the 13th, lasting until November the 3rd, The following agenda will be available to you. Election Year Politics, a course which is dedicated to examining issues and candidates, both presidential and congressional, and also gubernatorial. Another course, Something Wicked Comes This Way, Decoding the Demonic in Everyday Life. Here, the concept of the demonic over time is examined, as well as who and what is the devil. A third course, which should be of interest to many people, is about John Adams, the often overlooked founding father. This course is going to tell about Adams, his family, his turbulent times. It's based on the HBO series that many of you may be familiar with. And then you might say, for something completely different, there is a course entitled All or Nothing at All. If you're a Sinatra fan, you may remember that song. And this is a course about Frank Sinatra's life and his music. Then America, the Land and the People. This course examines places and people that define America and what it is to be an American and what Americanism means. And then the Up series continued. This covers documentary subjects in middle age in films, which are made every 7 years. It's a documentary series from England. Some of you may have seen this in earlier years. Then the 1960s, part two. This is a course which looks at the social and the political changes, including identity politics and the counterculture. There will be films shown in that course, one of which is one that many of us have seen and liked very much, and that was Dr. Strangelove. Then two more courses are offered. One is Drugs, Society, and Human Behavior. And this explains the whys, the effects, and the types of addiction and abuse. And finally, the Reconstruction Era, a course which presents us with ad hoc solutions to the problems after the Civil War, freedom and freed slaves, and the South versus the North as regions. And so there you have it. If you're interested in finding out more about these courses, call 815-753-5200. You can tell them that you're interested in one or more courses, and they'll tell you how to register. Now I'll continue with information of a different kind. If you think you're planning to be an expatriate and live overseas, you might like to know how an annual survey has ranked a number of countries as places to live if you want to live abroad. An annual survey by InterNations of 14,000 expatriates who were living in 191 countries found that Taiwan was the best location to live abroad. And that was based on such factors as quality of life, job security, and cost of living. And so, Taiwan enjoys number one ranking. Ecuador is a number three ranking. Bahrain in the Middle East comes in at number 19. And at number 25 is the United States. And at the bottom of my list that I have here, Italy is number 59. I'm not sure about this ranking. I think I would have turned it around a bit, because I've been to Italy a number of times, and I rather enjoy the experience at each time and visit. Well, still more information. This just in. In the recent edition of Time magazine, a roundup of new and noteworthy insights from the week's most talked-about studies. We have number one, how you believe meat was raised affects how good it tastes. A new study in the journal PLOS 1 found that people thought meat looked and smelled and tasted better when they were told that it had been raised on a humane farm, as opposed to an industrial feedlot. So you might mull that over for a bit. And then number two, coffee addiction might be genetic. A study in Scientific Reports that compared how much coffee people drink to their genomes found that a certain gene, PDSS2, may make people more receptive to caffeine. This could help explain why some people get more of a kick from their morning coffee than do others. Well, I know I do get a very certain kick from my morning coffee. And finally, number three. This shouldn't surprise the older generation. Older people are happier than people in their 20s. A study in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry, which focused on a sampling of people ages 21 to 99 living in San Diego, found that people in their 20s and 30s had the highest levels of anxiety, depression, and stress, while people in later generations had much higher levels of happiness. I could have told them that before they did their study. And now, to draw to the end of our program, I wanted to share with you something in that same issue of Time magazine. It's called The Future of Handwriting. It's easy for adults to bemoan that kids today are growing up typing and not writing, but the typed word is no less intellectual than longhand, so argues Anne Trubeck in her new book, The History and the Uncertain Future of Handwriting. Our attachments to handwriting, she explains, are primarily emotional, and our associations with intelligence and neat lettering have fluctuated over time. We variously linked bad handwriting with intelligence, think doctors, and stupidity. Teachers have been found to subconsciously give lower grades to papers with worse penmanship. What's important is not the neatness of our prose, but the volume. If anything, we are in a golden age of writing, says Trubeck. Most Americans write hundreds, if not thousands, of words more a day than they did 10 or 20 years ago. We have supplanted much talking and phone calling with texting, emailing, and social media. If you'd like more about this, pick up The History and Uncertain Future of Handwriting by Anne Trubeck. It's now in a bookstore near you. And that brings us to the end of our program today. I want you to come back, be with us again. Please be careful. Take care out there. And now, from Glenn Miller, Moonlight Serenade.